Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdraber. On today's show, President Trump has made his pick for FCC chairman. Commissioner Ajit Pai, who was a minority Republican commissioner under Chairman Tom Wheeler, has been elevated to the chairmanship. And while all we saw on Friday were news reports, we saw an official statement from now Chairman Pai yesterday thanking President Trump for the appointment. Joining me to discuss this is someone who knows some stuff about the FCC, not that much, but whatever. President of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka. Baron, are you upset that you were not selected?
Well, yes, of course, but I couldn't have asked for a better pick than Ajit. He is everything that people say they want these days, which is thoughtful, well-tempered, open-minded, and funny. He is, and we've talked about this on the show before, but you could not ask for a more pop culturally literate person to be in that role who can write entire dissents from The Big Lebowski.
Yes. And when we say that, we mean he throws a reference in. He doesn't just take the dialogue or the script from The Big Lebowski and use that as a dissent, but that would have been funny too.
Well, say what you will about Tom Wheeler. At least he had an ethos.
Okay. Let's start with an issue that we haven't talked about on the show before. It's prison payphones. And this might be slightly surprising to some people because on the Tech Policy Podcast, we try to generally keep things high tech and there's nothing less low tech. No, sorry, I used that. There's nothing more low tech these days when we're talking about FCC stuff than payphones, right? But here we are. This is an issue where the FCC plays a role. And briefly, before we get into the policy, what does the FCC have to do with this? This seems, you know, prisons, we think of this as a local issue, it's a municipality, or it's a state issue. Why is the FCC focused so much on broadband and video and things like that? What do they have to do with payphones?
Well, remember, the FCC has jurisdiction over interstate calling. So the issue here, this has been brewing for now 13 years, back in 2003.
Right when Baron got out of prison, actually. So this is really a personal issue for him.
If you count law school as prison, it almost lines up. So in 2003, a woman filed a petition with the FCC asking for relief, saying that the rates that she was being charged to call her loved ones were too high, and asking the FCC to do something. The FCC essentially sat on this issue for about a decade. And then finally, the FCC had put out a request for public comment asking what should be done about it. And in particular, it's an awkward situation because it's a true monopoly. It's a literally captive audience. And even worse than that, prisons have used the revenue that they get from these exclusive deals with a single provider of that payphone service to fund the prison's other operations. And it's complicated because, as you can imagine, these are not normal payphones. Everything has to be monitored. So it is an expensive service. It's also true that the rates that are being charged are monopoly rates, or at least were higher than you would expect. So the FCC put out a request asking for comments as to what to do about this when the first FCC chairman under President Obama, Julius Genachowski, when he stepped down, there was a brief period of an interim chairmanship under Mignon Clyburn.
Yeah, who's currently the sole Democrat on the FCC. So she will be there at least until she resigns or until July.
Right. So to her credit, she decided that it was time to do something on this issue. And she was quite right that it had been far too long delayed. Unfortunately, she was in such a rush to do something that she decided that she was going to A, move immediately, and B, change what the FCC was doing. The FCC had asked, had proposed one approach to this problem, which was rate caps, depending on the size of the facility. She changed the approach to a rate of return regulation, which is essentially the old public utility model. That's what the left has always wanted. When we talk about the Title II broadband debate, really, ideally, they want a monopoly. They just want the government to regulate the rates. So in other words, she picked the most hardline solution in order to be able to say that she'd done the most she could. And she didn't seem to care about the fact that she was changing what the agency had proposed. And that really required another notice. But she didn't have time to do that because she was, of course, only an interim chairman. This is a long way of saying that the agency moved, good for them, but they did it wrong. And they got tied up in court, and the agency has now gone back and forth with the DC Circuit. And unfortunately, the very real people who have been suffering because they cannot afford to talk to their loved ones in prison have really been denied justice. And in some cases, the payphone service, and at least in small facilities, may have been discontinued. So this is just something that I think is going to be top of mind for Ajit to try to extricate the FCC from this long-running legal battle, to demonstrate that he can work with Mignon Clyburn and do something that is really, really important, especially to the minority community who is disproportionately affected by these high rates. He needs to put this on a sound footing moving forward.
And just so listeners understand the process failure that led to the FCC losing in court, we've talked about this on the show before. This is how regulation in America works when there's a rulemaking. An agency puts out a proposal. Anyone, you, tech freedom experts, not experts, anyone can comment. It's public comment. This is a good government practice. But when you then change the rule in a dramatic way, you now should have to give the public another opportunity to comment, because what they originally comment on is not the new item, and the comments are either mooted or they're not comprehensive enough. And this is just a good government practice. And
it's not just a good government practice. It's actually something that is required, depending on the circumstances, by the courts.
Right. And when we're talking about something so heartbreaking like a prisoner who basically has to work in the prison to make whatever money he can, and then all of that goes to the payphone because it is so outrageously expensive, that's a very heartbreaking circumstance. And that's why proper process matters even more when you have something like this, because the FCC, in its rush to do something, violated the proper process, and then people are suffering. So what is, let's not spend the whole show on prison payphones, but what is the smart bipartisan solution to this problem, since now Chairman Pai had actually advocated a compromise during this debate?
Yeah, well, the compromise is basically to do something like what the agency had originally proposed, which is, yes, to cap rates, but to do it as a rate cap. That's a different approach from rate of return regulation.
Which is actually deciding what they can charge.
Yeah, and in a way that ultimately, this is complicated, and I don't want to get too much into details because this has changed several times. But suffice it to say that if those who are interested want to, they can go back and read Ajit's dissent from when this was first voted on. He's laid this all out. And in general, and this is what we'll be talking about today, in many cases, one doesn't really have to speculate about what Ajit's going to do because he's laid it out in his dissents. Either he said what the legally sound way to do it is or what the policy solution is. And my general point, and the reason we wanted to start here, is to say that he has an opportunity not just to use better process, which he's said for years is important, and which, again, is important because if you take this ready, fire, aim approach, you often end up not really helping the people you claim you're helping. So not only is he likely to work on those good government things, but also I think he's laid out an agenda that is that offers a roadmap for potential bipartisan agreement between the one Democrat left on the commission and the two Republicans.
So ever since this announcement was made on Friday, at least the news reports that Pai was going to get picked, we've seen hashtag tech reporting just a parade of horribles. I mean, every headline you read, if it's not necessarily a thoughtful outlet, you're going to see net neutrality will be gutted, this man is a monster, you know, just on and on and on, right? And obviously, if we're trying to be bipartisan, it cannot be the case that so many people think he's wonderfully qualified and a great guy and he's going to seek to be bipartisan, and all these other people say that he's a monster and he's just going to ruin everything and poor people are screwed, right? This cannot be the case. There has to be some type of truth here that we can figure out. And there's a reason we start the show with prison payphones, because I want to address these concerns from the left that so many valuable programs for social justice, for helping low-income people, are just going to be gutted and destroyed, and this is Trump's war and blah, blah, blah. So let's get on to more bipartisan opportunities. Universal service in the United States. We have decided that, you know, back in the day, that the telephone was so important that when private investment wasn't necessarily enough to get service out to people, that taxpayers would help out. And the FCC under Chairman Wheeler decided to add broadband to the Universal Service Lifeline program. The conventional wisdom, if you read a lot of this tech press, is that this is terrible for Lifeline, right? That Universal Service will be screwed because Republicans are now in charge. What do you have to say to that?
Well, first, let me just start by saying that Ajit is not some sort of East Coast elitist. He's first generation Indian American, grew up in Kansas in a rural area. His parents worked very hard and put him through the University of Chicago. he is somebody who I think, in addition to being a nice and funny guy, has a great deal of empathy for real people and an understanding of the reality of universal service. And indeed, that's true for Republicans generally. I mean, the Republican Party is largely a party of rural America, which is to say low density areas that are huge net beneficiaries of universal service, right? So universal service, just to remind everybody, has two really important programs. There are several, but one is there are subsidies to high cost areas, which is low density, basically, where it costs a lot of money to deploy service.
Yeah, where we are literally talking about pipes, wires, right. Phone lines, things like that. Yeah.
And then there's the Lifeline program, which is for low-income folks. And now that there's some overlap here, right? Because those low-income folks are in rural areas, but they're also heavily in cities. The point is that there is no appetite among Republicans on the Hill for gutting universal service or ending it. But it is high time that we actually re-examine how the program works. And you actually saw, I don't need to hypothesize about what bipartisan compromise would look like, because you actually saw Ajit negotiate a bipartisan compromise with Democrat Mignon Clyburn.
Who's still going to be there when he's chairman.
Yeah. Right. And we did a show on this, and we'll link to it in the show notes. This was, I believe this was about 10 months ago. And it was just extraordinary what happened, because this would have been the first time that a Democrat and Republican had crossed the aisle to negotiate a deal in the Wheeler administration. And Wheeler flipped out. It was the only meeting of his term where the meeting itself was delayed. So for the details of what actually happened here, you can go and listen to the episode we did on this with Matthew Berry, Ajit Pai's chief of staff, about 10 months ago, and we'll link to that in the show notes. But to summarize, under immense pressure at the 11th hour, literally right before the meeting where this was scheduled to go up for a vote and where a bipartisan compromise would have passed.
They'd been up all night negotiating, and it would have at least gotten voted on it would have passed with a 3-2 at least, if not 4-1. But we know that the two Republicans and Clyburn did support the deal.
Right, exactly. So that deal was scuttled by the chairman under immense pressure in a really nasty way.
Yeah.
And the point is that there was an appetite for bipartisanship. Ajit and Mignon demonstrated they could do it. And the contours of the deal were pretty simple. The key thing from Ajit's perspective is that the universal service program it's a multi-billion dollar program that does not have a budget. Every year, the amount that is taxed on consumers' bills, right? Because it's ratepayers. It's not actually taxpayers, technically. It's those you pay a what is not called a tax, but is effectively a tax on your telephone bill. And the amount you pay every year is just determined by how much demand there is for the program. That's a crazy way to run a multi-billion dollar subsidy.
And yeah, so no one's voting on this. There's no congressional input. It just goes up and down. And yeah, I mean, in some weird, perverse way, you can say that it's kind of a market mechanism because it's based on demand. But if you don't have an accountability mechanism, if you don't have a cap on the budget, there is very little incentive to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. And people who often see government as the solution to all of our telecommunications woes have very little incentive to cap the program either. And our good friends on the left do not support capping this program. And they were very much glad to see Wheeler scuttle the deal, even though they basically agree with Commissioner Clyburn on almost every single issue ever. But this time they didn't agree.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the point. So that's one screwy thing about how universal service works. The second insane thing about universal service is that you are taxing a service in order to promote it. So you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, which is to say that let's say 95% of the population pays the exact same rate, the universal service rate, in order to subsidize, let's say, 5% of the population's service. What that means is that if you're in the sixth percentile, your service is 17 to 20% more expensive, whatever the rate contribution rate ends up being for that year. You're paying that tax even though you're right on the border of being eligible to qualify for getting it for free or heavily discounted. And that's because this has been left up to the FCC to run in this screwy way where they're collecting these things that aren't supposedly taxes. That's how they got around Congress. This is a long way of saying that real reform of the program is long overdue. And what it really ideally means is that Congress changes how this works and ideally funds the program out of general tax receipts, right? Like every other program in America is funded, which ensures some democratic accountability, which allows for progressive taxation, right? I mean, that's not supposed to be a right-wing idea, right? But here's this weird situation where here we are saying that it's kind of screwy, that everyone pays the same percentage rate on that on their bill.
And to use a classic talking point from other debates about taxes, Warren Buffett's janitor, who pays for the same like internet or phone services, Warren Buffett pays the same tax rate as Warren Buffett. That's exactly crazy, right? So if you support the idea of progressive taxation, that the rich should pay more, then the only way really to get there with this program would be to have it come out of the general treasury, because those funds are gathered through progressive taxation, some other types of taxation.
Exactly. And then there's one third crazy thing about universal service, which is that if you actually ask economists about this, they'll tell you that the FCC has just failed to study how well the program actually works. It's not clear that we're spending that pot of money in the most effective way, because a lot of that money is going to people who would buy service anyway. And if that's the case, we're better off taking those subsidies and funding people who just aren't going to get service at all. So this is just a really good example of where better economic analysis actually would be highly progressive. It would serve the social justice ends of this program. And I expect that you'll see that kind of reform, those kinds of questions asked by the FCC. And if they don't do the reforms themselves, because there may be limits on how far they can go, they're going to set this up, I think, for Congress to finally do something that ought to be able to attract broad bipartisan support.
Yeah. And for all the gloom and doom, I would be very surprised. I'm sure you would be too, if Republican control of government and Republican control of the FCC meant a gutting of universal service. I think that's a little crazy.
And one final thing, this is all coming to a head now because the program is being expanded to cover broadband. That's the key detail that we hadn't mentioned yet. And that raises the question, the FCC can do that now without Title II, which we're going to talk about. But the question that the FCC has raised is about taxing broadband to fund this program. And that's going to be a huge tax hike on ordinary Americans. The FCC is going to have to figure out how to handle this. And really, ideally, as I said, this should be handled through general taxation by Congress.
So let's talk about, we'll change gears. We'll get back to the internet and broadband deployment and things like that. But next generation broadcasting. You hear a lot about cord cutting these days. There are a lot of ways to consume media. But people often forget that you can go on Amazon or wherever and pay, you know, $25, get an antenna, hook it up to your TV and get a bunch of free HD television because it is the public airwaves that, you know, NBC, CBS, and a couple of your local stations they're using. And the people in the broadcasting business will say, we're the only game in town that's free. Of course, there's radio as well. But how is next generation broadcasting going to come about, right? I mean, you've got, if you have a Roku and Netflix, you can stream 4K. If you've got a PlayStation 4 and the right kind of television, you can get 4K ultra high def. The only way that you can get that picture quality just by using an antenna is with FCC action, because right now broadcasters are not allowed to use the new standard. I believe it's something like ATSC 3.0. You can look that up. I'm not going to say that that's definite, but they need the FCC to bless this. And this is generally seen as fairly uncontroversial. There are some concerns among Republican commissioners, but the FCC just didn't do anything on this. And when I've asked people in this business why they think the FCC didn't do anything on what should have been a 5-0, you know, open and shut case, is that they were too busy on all the partisan stuff that we've talked about on this show that is likely going to get undone or maybe resolved through legislation. Do you have any thoughts on next gen? I mean, this should be pretty easy, right?
Well, you summarized the issue quite well. The point here is really just about misprioritization. This is something that should have happened a long time ago. And yes, there are questions still to be answered. But the last chairman just didn't want to invest any time in trying to resolve those issues. So what I think you'll see happen is that the FCC is going to actually try to resolve those questions and move forward instead of kicking the can down the road. So you're going to see this will just be an example of a large shift in how the agency prioritizes its work.
Yeah. And if this goes well, you'll be able to hopefully buy a new device or add a, you know, we use the term dongle. It's like the worst thing ever. And there was actually a online campaign to change the name of the term dongle, and the vote ended up being for dongle. So we're stuck with that. It was something that you could plug into your TV that would give it the new ability to do 4K with an antenna. So that's something exciting. That's a piece of hopefully good news. Won't be hyper partisan. We can all kind of get behind that so that broadcasters can better compete with Netflix and Roku, and we can all, as consumers, reap the benefits of the golden age of television. Moving back to broadband, I mean, this is the place for common ground. I mean, unavoidably, things like net neutrality might get partisan, things like universal service. There are just issues in telecom that get very politicized, that get partisan, and it's hard to avoid that because people are very passionate about it. One thing that everyone's passionate about that we can kind of all agree on is that we should have better broadband, more choices, newer service, faster service, better upgrades, all the wonderful things. We disagree about how to get there. But given that Trump has picked pie, what are the prospects for things like his gigabit opportunity zones? I mean, I'll just let you go off because you probably have a million things to say.
Well, just to tie these two conversations together, one of the points of the next gen broadcasting thing is that if you have that as an option, it becomes easier to cut the cord from your cable or other multi-channel video programming distributor, because you can then tie that over-the-air content you're getting in very high quality with Netflix or Amazon or whatever other package you get. So it's just to say that it's breaking down the bundle, and it relates to broadband deployment because the more that we start to separate the video programming package from the broadband package, the better that is for broadband competition. The more it means that, let's say, a Google Fiber is able to compete with incumbents because they don't necessarily have to offer a video service at all. And really what you're going to see in the coming years, and you're already starting to see this, is most notably AT&T's DirecTV Now. So they're taking these video services and they're taking them over the top, which means that you could get DirecTV Now on your Verizon Fios or Google Fiber subscription. You don't have to pick your broadband provider because of the video package, right? So that's one important dimension of competition here. And I think that's going to become even more significant as we start moving towards 5G. So we've talked a lot about on the show, and we could link to an episode or two we've done about this, about how 5G is coming, probably, let's say, 4 years out in deployment. But it's a way of having much denser wireless networks. So instead of having towers that are a kilometer or two apart from each other, you're going to have very dense networks of small cells in cities. They're going to be on buildings. They might be on street lamps and so on. And they'll deliver service speeds of hundreds of megabits, if not gigabit speed. And video is going to be the killer app, which is what AT&T is trying to deliver with this DirecTV Now package, which is in part why they're buying Time Warner. Time Warner, the programming company, not Time Warner Cable.
Yes, important distinction.
Right. So anyway, so lots of interesting stuff is happening. And I think when we look back at this moment in 10 years, I think we'll see that this was another transformational moment, just like the there was a time when people laughed at the idea that wireless phone service was substitutable for wireline service. The 96 Act, what Congress had in mind for telephone competition, was you'd create all these artificial telephone resellers, where in fact what actually happened is you had technological facilities-based competition whereby a third of Americans just got their service from their wireless provider and a third got some kind of VoIP service from their cable provider, right? So that same sort of thing is happening now. Those silos are breaking down, and you're seeing also the rise of mesh networks. I mean, you might want to mention your new phone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just a personal anecdote about how competition has impacted my bottom line. I have Comcast at home as my wired broadband. I noticed that DC is just all over the place. Comcast has put up these mesh networks, and without getting into technical details, when you open your phone and you see a Wi-Fi network that is the name of a broadband provider, that is almost always a mesh network. It's everyone in DC that has a Comcast router is emitting a very small amount of their bandwidth and signal just to the street. And that is this shared experience where we can all kind of go around. And I've switched over to Google Project Fi because you only pay for the data you use. And when I'm running around DC connecting to Comcast Wi-Fi all the time, I very rarely use the Google network. So just to illustrate—
Meaning the 4G—
Right, the 4G LTE
Sprint and
Sprint T-Mobile combined thing that Google is doing, which is very cool. But just to show that a lot of people on the left often complain that low-income people are forced to choose between wireless and wireline. There are ways to combine the two. There are ways to substitute. If I really, in a pinch, needed to, I could probably cancel my Google Fi subscription and still get around just with a Comcast. So just to show you that while as recently as a year or two ago, Chairman Tom Wheeler mocked the idea that wireless can compete with wireline, and the FCC had this fetish where every single person, whether you lived in a lake house in Minnesota or an apartment building in Manhattan, that you were going to have a fiber connection to your home, ideally built by the government. Maybe we can move away from that. And I think a lot of people are looking forward to a more holistic approach to broadband where you say, look, if we're in the middle of rural Kansas, maybe where somewhere where the new chairman would recognize, it might not make sense to have fiber go directly to someone's house. Maybe it makes more sense to have 5G, to have fiber powered wireless, whatever it is. But let's not just dismiss wireless because it doesn't fit into the same regulatory silo as wireline. As you say, it's 2017. These walls don't make sense. Let's destroy the walls.
And the really important thing here is that in a fantasy world where there was unlimited money, of course, you would wire every home and building in America with fiber. But in the real world, consumers actually, or taxpayers, have to pay the cost, right? And if you can avoid the enormous cost of wiring existing buildings with fiber, let's say, and instead deploy fiber onto the street level and then use a 5G infrastructure from there, or you can build mesh networks in the way that you're describing, what that ultimately means is cheaper service for consumers. And the people that benefit most from that are the people at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. So, and that's why you've seen over the years a lot of pragmatism from the Congressional Black Caucus, from Mignon Clyburn, and then from people in rural America, right? And I think that's the opportunity that Ajit Pai has at the FCC. You started out your question by asking about his broadband empowerment agenda. I think it's worth talking about that. That refers to a speech that he gave last year before the election, laying out his vision for what the FCC should be doing, saying basically that the FCC shouldn't be spending so much of its limited time and resources fighting these regulatory fights. It takes huge amount of staff resources. And that instead, it should be focusing on doing the things that Congress really required it to do, the things that involve real harm to consumers, and then spending some of the resources that are freed up thinking about ways to make broadband deployment easier. And at the core of that proposal are two related ideas. So the first is the idea of gigabit empowerment zones. He's borrowing an idea there from Jack Kemp, the great Republican champion of urban America, who ended up being housing secretary under the first President Bush. His idea was urban empowerment zones, where you'd have tax incentives to invest and build businesses, right? And based on the real time that he actually spent as a New York congressman in cities like Harlem, for example. So Ajit's idea is similar to that. It's saying that in low-income, underserved areas, you could have a variety of federal incentives to encourage deployment. But the most important thing about that idea, and the part that links it to the second part, is that those localities would have to satisfy some minimum standard of making deployment easy. They'd have to cut red tape. We've talked about this on the show. They'd have to do those libertarian things, but also have some smart, progressive, smart infrastructure policies, like, for example, planning to do conduits in the streets or the sidewalks.
Yeah, it is insane. Anytime a city government spends money to dig up a street, which is extremely costly and disruptive, and it annoys the crap out of everyone who lives near it, you don't want to have to do that again. And that's why you get this jargon term in our field of work called dig once. When you dig up the street, there's no reason not to put in these plastic tubes, very cheap, that then later on a private provider could thread fiber through, but they don't have to dig up the whole street again, which is one of the biggest barriers to broadband deployment, if not the biggest.
Yeah, it's a big barrier everywhere. So it's a problem in urban areas, and it's increasingly going to be a problem for 5G deployment, because to do 5G right, to get that sort of gigabit speed that it can deliver, what you need is to have that conduit through which you can thread fiber, and to put it under not just streets, but sidewalks. You need to start thinking about all the other infrastructure that could be used. It could be buildings, but ideally what you'd want is that cities would start thinking, okay, we're starting to upgrade our street lamps or our stoplights. Well, those are masts, as they would say in Britain, that could be used for putting up 5G antennas. So you could build, you could pay a little bit more for those, make sure that they are fiber ready. They could plug into a standard conduit in the sidewalk. And then you could leave it to private providers to lease that infrastructure from the government and pay for its cost and use that to deploy antennas through for 5G service. So getting back to Ajit's idea, his point is that on the one hand, offer these incentives in low-income areas for localities that do those smart things, but also have a new focus at the FCC. This is an idea that we proposed 2 or 3 years ago of saying that the FCC should be using its resources to coordinate, not to mandate or order, but to coordinate localities and states and to figure out best practices for making broadband deployment easier. And that's everything from the roads and streets to building codes. There's a lot of stuff that could be done. And these two things intersect because if the FCC is coordinating that effort, is bringing together those policymakers and people from all sorts of departments, right? It's not just the transportation or the communications people. It's everyone in the state government, right? The people in the reservations. And just there's a lot of people that ought to be coordinated. That could be a way to make broadband deployment easier by laying out best practices that cities could have an incentive to adopt, but also that they would just see would be a way forward. And I would just sum all this up by saying that's a different model of the agency from Tom Wheeler's model, which is that the FCC's job was command and control, is to tell, is to regulate, to preempt states, to tell them what to do, versus this model, which is developing best practices and in largely leaving it up to cities and hoping that the market for governments will work to allow those cities that want to leapfrog their competitors, their neighboring city, right? So, you know, Springfield versus Shelbyville, right? You want to feed that dynamic in a healthy way, in a way that taps the private sector, maximizes private investment, instead of having the government build everything.
So getting to the topic that I've successfully buried at the end of the show, because we talked about it on a previous episode called Trump's FCC. So if you want to deep dive into net neutrality, listen to that one again. But let's just try to see if anything's really changed on this topic since the last time we talked about it. You've had a statement from Senator John Thune. He is the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction over issues like broadband. And he has said that he thinks Pi getting picked as chairman will grease the skids. Is that a term? Is that a phrase?
It is.
Okay, great. For net neutrality legislation. And of course, I mentioned that a lot of the headlines after Pi got picked were net neutrality is dead. This is the guy that's going to kill net neutrality opponent appointed to FTC. Really positive framings, really great for bipartisan cooperation. Nonetheless,
new ones too.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Nonetheless, Thune thinks this is great for bipartisan net neutrality legislation. I'm sure Chairman Walden, his counterpart in the House, feels the same way. The very short version, what do you see happening the next couple of months? Maybe next year, the next year with net neutrality.
Right. When people talk about net neutrality, you have to ask what they actually mean. If what you mean is the core of the issue, which is those four basic freedoms that Republican Michael Powell laid out in 2004, if what you mean is the idea that broadband providers shouldn't be blocking traffic or applications or lying to their customers or throttling their affiliate, their competitors' content. And if that's what you mean, nothing's going to change. That's never been controversial. There are no broadband providers that want to do those things, and there have always been other legal mechanisms to deal with them. On the other hand, if what you mean is the FCC's claims of legal authority under Title II to regulate broadband as a common carrier, or 706, which the FCC claims allows it to regulate really any form of communications in any way that promotes broadband.
Yeah, two broad legal interpretations that Tom Wheeler said gave him a lot of authority.
Right. Those two things are going to disappear. It's just a question of time. It's either the FCC is going to do it on its own, or Congress will do that. And I hope Congress will make that permanent so we don't ping pong back and forth between Republican and Democratic FCCs. But those are two ends of the spectrum of things that get wrapped up in the term net neutrality. And in the middle, there's a range of stuff that you could mean as a policy matter about how to deal with non-neutral conduct that doesn't quite fit the ideal, right? That is zero rating, for example, giving away free data.
Yeah.
Free data, thank you, better term, right? Or there are any number of specific questions. And we have always said that those could be problematic, but we should deal with them on a harms-based standard. And in general, the government shouldn't be banning things that might be good for consumers. So there, you know, if the FCC or the FTC ends up regulating those things on a more case-by-case basis and policing really harmful conduct, I would say that net neutrality hasn't died. It's simply grown up.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. And while there are some who'd prefer to see the FCC burn to the ground and never regulate broadband at all, we have to be realistic, right? There are 8 Democratic votes you need in the Senate, assuming all Republicans hold the line, which is not a fair assumption on tech policy issues at all. You need bipartisanship on this issue. And if the FCC just does it unilaterally, nothing to stop a future Democratic FCC from doing the same thing. Let's hope that in all the freaking out about Tom Wheeler's agenda going up in flames, that people have learned a valuable lesson about process, about having Republicans add input. And if you had gotten a net neutrality item through with Pi and O'Reilly voting for it the first time, we might not be having this conversation about the death of net neutrality. But yeah, it passed 3-2 in the most partisan way you could possibly imagine. Now, luckily for supporters of net neutrality, this is not the end. And already you have the two Republicans who handle this issue in the House and Senate saying that they still want to do a deal. It might be not 70% Democrats what they want and, you know, 30% Republicans want, which the deal you could say was that that's the deal that they came up with last year when the politics.
Or 2 years ago, Republicans offered a deal to Democrats that would essentially have codified the FCC's rules but blocked its claims of legal authority, and no Democrat would actually take the deal.
Right. And now there's a chance of something like that happening. Maybe Republicans get a little bit more of what they want, but, you know, I just like I said, I'd be really shocked if universal service was just gutted and all these terrible things happened that all the certain columnists and journalists are saying. I'd be surprised if the entirety of net neutrality went away and that then we see Comcast throttling AT&T products and vice versa. Yeah, this is not going to happen.
Even if in my ideal world, this entire issue of broadband gets kicked over to the Federal Trade Commission, even then, while it's true that the FTC has a different set of legal standards, even then, the new baseline, really, before the FTC actually has to show consumer harm or anti-competitive effect or whatever, is going to be enforcement of the promises that the companies themselves make and that an industry code of conduct makes. And they are all going to agree to the baseline that they helped to write in the open internet rules. Again, that's not been controversial. So to me, this is really a fake debate, and it always has been. And we could have resolved this issue several times. Congress has 3 times missed the boat, at least, on legislation. And now it's finally going to happen. And basically, it's going to be something between the FCC continuing to regulate on a more FTC-like standard, or in my ideal world, these issues being transferred over to the Federal Trade Commission.
All right. Well, you've got a range of options to explore there. And just to kind of recap, we talked about a lot of things today, but there are real prospects for bipartisanship, both at the FCC and in Congress, on issues like prison payphones, capping the rates, not regulating the rates themselves. That could be a solution. On universal service, just making sure there's a cap on that program, making sure that there's economic analysis to make sure that the program's being used in the best way possible. This is billions of dollars of taxpayer money. We want to make sure it's going to the right place. Next generation broadcasting. This should be an easy one, as long as these concerns that Republicans have can be ironed out. No reason to not think that consumers shouldn't be able to have 4K Ultra HD content with an antenna. And that is a benefit that you have as a taxpayer.
I can see the signs now. ATSC 3.0 now.
Yeah, let's come up with, I think that's why they call it next gen, because that is not at all sexy. Easing broadband deployment, right? I mean, 2 things Pi's already laid out. You can look at our work on techfreedom.org to see more, but gigabit opportunity zones, the joint conference so that all 3 levels of government, local, state, and federal, can work these things out. And finally, let's just get net neutrality out of the way. It has really just held up everything else.
And so we can move on to the many other things that Congress needs to legislate about in this area, including broadband deployment, including dealing with the rest of how the FCC works and regulates other things. There's a lot to be done. And essentially, my final word here would be to say that the legislative process here has been constipated for about 20 years, right? We had the Telecom Act in 96, the last really serious act here. And even that missed the boat. It didn't do what even the Clinton administration understood was necessary, which was technologically neutral regulation that doesn't depend on these artificial silos that disappear over time. So we got to go back to basically 94 and start over.
Well, can the FCC really be great again without Baron Soka as its chairman? We'll certainly find out, but he seems to be pretty bullish about pie.
More people will come if we tell them there will be pie.
Wow. All right. Well, now we seriously have to end the show because we're just getting absurd. Jilted candidate for FCC chairman and president of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka. Baron, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Let us know what you think of these episodes with Baron that are always twice as long as all our other episodes.
And let us know if you'd prefer that Sean Spicer, if things don't work out at the White House, take over the show.
That would be really interesting. Send us an email, media@techfreedom.org. Let us know what you think, topics you want to hear, guests you want to see. Feel free to pitch yourself as a guest. And of course,
poor host.
Please leave us a review in the iTunes store. I know I ask you to do that, but you don't actually do it. So if you could do it, that'd be great. Passive-aggressive comment to end the show. We'll be in your podcast app soon enough.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.